Okay, so, right, this is work in progress with Jeff Harvey and Petr Horjava to appear shortly. So, Petr gave a talk on...
Work or fun?
Well, can we ever separate the two? I mean, you know. Petr gave a talk at this at the conference about some of these issues last month, so I made some effort to not overlap, have some non-overlap with his material, and talk relatively brief since you have heard some of this stuff before. Okay, so here's a outline of what I'll be talking about. Start with a review of some properties of non-BPSD brains, mainly following the work of Sen over the past couple of years. Then turn to their interpretation as desvalorons in string theory. In particular, I'll discuss how to formulate multi-desvalorons, coincident desvalorons, and how one counts the spectrum of negative modes in such objects. Then I'll have some comments about attempts to find supergravity descriptions of these unstable non-BPSD brains. And finally, some comments on D8 brains, BPSD8 brains, quantization of the cosmological constant in massive 2A, and related matters. Okay, so in type 2 string theory, we're all familiar with BPSD brains that we know and love, our stable, supersymmetric objects carrying Ramon Ramon charge and many other wonderful properties. But these are not the only D brains in type 2 string theory. So as Sen and Bergman and Gabardiel and others have been studying over the past couple of years, there are non-BPS D brains in type 2 string theory. These are non-supersymmetric, unstable, yet perfectly consistent objects in string theory, as you can see, for example, from the boundary state formulation of these things. So given that we're eventually interested in understanding non-supersymmetric string theory, we'd like to understand these non-supersymmetric D brains. So in some cases, you can actually form stable non-supersymmetric D-brains, as explained by these authors. That's not what I'll be talking about. I'll be only talking about unstable non-BPSD brains. So in two... Well, you can formulate consistent, you know, CST and interactions and so forth. I mean... Well, so I'll discuss how you see the instability. I mean, if you quantize open strings, what we see an explicit tachyonic mode. So I think that's the new understanding of Sen, that if you have a tachyon, it doesn't necessarily mean you have a fundamental inconsistency. It just means you have some Higgs mechanism occurring, and so a tachyon can roll consistent. So the basic building blocks in the story are in 2A, we look at the odd D brains, not the even ones we're used to, and we also look at coincident bound states of a BPSD brain with an anti-BPSD brain. Similarly, in type 2B, we'll look at even non-BPS brains and coincident BPS D brains and anti-D brains. Okay, so these are D brains, by which I mean open strings can end on these objects, but the rules are different than for non-BPSD brains. And it's actually quite simple to analyze how those rules work. So let's start with the DP-anti-DP system. And the idea is to look at the cylinder diagram between a DP and an anti-DP and do the comparison between the open string channel and the closed string channel. In particular, let's look at the amplitude for closed string Ramon-Ramon exchange. So since this is an anti-DP as compared to the normal DP, basically we just want to flip the sign of the Ramon-Ramon closed string exchange because we flip the sign of the Ramon-Ramon charge of the D brain. Now, in the Ramon-Ramon sector, the fermions are periodic around the cylinder. In the open string one-loop diagram, that corresponds to an insertion of negative 1 to the f into the path integral. And so if we want to flip the sign of this exchange, we should flip the sign of negative 1 to the f. And what that means then is then in the GSO projection operator, we flip the sign, and so we take an opposite GSO projection for PP bar strings as compared to the usual PP strings. So then, so before we do a GSO projection, when we quantize the open strings, we find a tachyon, a gauge field, and some scalars from the NS sector, and then fermions from the Ramon sector. now we do the GSO projection. So for the normal PP strings, we would throw out the tachyon and one chirality of fermions, leaving the gauge field scalars and positive chirality fermions. Now for the TP bar strings, we do the opposite. We keep the tachyon and the negative chirality fermion and throw out the other ones. So that tells us right away what the world volume theory is then on N coincident DP anti-DP pairs. We have a UN cross UN gauge theory. In addition, here we have the dimensional, in total from these things, we have the dimensional reduction of 10-dimensional UN cross UN gauge theory. And then from these, we have a tachyon and a negative chirality fermion in the bifundamental. Okay, so that's how you see the tachyon.
You're not keeping the gauge field. So does it still have a gauge theory?
I'm keeping the gauge field from the PP strings. So I have this. Right, I don't get any new gauge degrees of freedom when I bring these things together.
Has someone that studies the other brains that end on those?
Other brains end on. I'm not aware of studies, but I'm not sure. Okay, so a similar story goes through then for the non-BPS DP brain. These objects carry no Ramon-Ramon charge at all, and so in the cylinder diagram, you don't want to take any GSO projection at all. There's no RR exchange. So that means we keep all of the states here from the top. And so so now we have UN gauge theory and all these fields in the adjoint of UN. Okay, so those are the basic theories. Now, when you're doing computations in these theories, it's convenient for these objects to assign Chan-Patton factors to the various strings. So in particular, let me take a single DP anti-DP or a single non-BPS DP, in which case you assign 2 by 2 Chan-Patton factors. And for strings that begin and end on the same brain here, you assign 1 and sigma 3. And then for the PP bar strings, you have Chan-Patton factors sigma 1 and sigma 2. These are the Pauli matrices. For the DP, you have unit matrix for these fields and the sigma 1 for the new ones. So, of course, when we do disk diagrams, say for the DP, we take a trace over Chan-Patton factors. And since sigma 1 here has zero trace, you see that there's a Z2 symmetry under which we flip the sign of the tachyon and the psi minus. Okay, so where things get interesting now is in the interpretation of this tachyon, which is the observation of Sen. So the tachyon is not meant to be an incurable instability. It's basically signaling a Higgs mechanism. So according to Sen, the tachyon has some potential V of t, and the states that we've constructed previously are sitting at the top of this potential at the vanishing tachyon with some positive value for the potential. And we hypothesize that V of t has some minima at some points, t0, where the potential actually vanishes. And we'll identify those points with the supersymmetric type 2 vacuum. And so the tachyon will roll down from t equals 0 down to t0 and will restore supersymmetry. So there are two basic shapes for such potentials, depending whether we take the DP anti-DP or the non-BPS DP. From what I showed you before, in this case, the tachyon is complex, and so we have some sort of Mexican hat potential for the tachyon. For the DP, we have a real tachyon, and so we have a double well potential. That's for a single.
But then, when you have such a picture, does it mean a new solution you will find out, it will be a stable solution, will be BPS, it could be BPS then.
At the bottom.
So you are, yeah.
That's what we expect. There is a BPS solution at the bottom. Right. That's the expectation. Then the vacuum, if you will, down. Okay. So that's for a single one. In a general case of N of these objects, for the DP anti-DP system, we'll generically consider cases where the tachyon rolls down to being proportional to the unit matrix in N by N space. And so that Higgs's the original UN cross UN gauge theory down to the diagonal UN, giving us the vacuum manifold UN cross UN divided by UN. Similarly, for the non-BPS DP brain, it's convenient to take 2N of these objects and to look at the following vacuum configurations for the tachyon. So I'll explain later why I'm taking even numbers and why it's nice to take a traceless tachyon. But given that I do this, we then have the Higgsing mechanism, U2N goes down to UN cross UN, and the vacuum manifold U2N cross UN. Well, this is the group that acts on the tachyon. So under under UN cross UN divided by UN rotations, I rotate the tachyon field.
Both kinds of tachyon exist in all cases, or both kinds of non-GPS frame exist in all cases?
Both kinds of, well.
I'm just wondering what circumstances one exists in more
than one. Right, both of these exist for 2A, 2B, for all P. I mean, well, yeah, both of these exist. Right.
But there's no charge. The Ramon charge is around zero. Mm-hmm. So you have GPS data, so what is sort of the analog of the charge?
There's no charge. I mean, only one need a charge if I had a... I mean, it's not really BPS. It's preserved all the supersymmetries. If I go down here, if I go homogeneously to the vacuum, this is the regular vacuum.
No, so in this way, it's also BPS, but it's more.
I don't know whatever the definition of BPS. It doesn't preserve all the supersymmetries. I'm not sure if you want to call that BPS or not. If it rolls down everywhere in the same place, then there's no defect, and there's all supersymmetries. So in this transparency, a simple example of where what happens when you don't roll down homogeneously. So what we can do here is if we can form defects by rolling down different places and different parts of the potential in different places in space. So in particular, I start with a DP anti-DP. Now I have this Mexican hat potential. Now what if I take the tachyon? I'm going to try to build a kink configuration out of this potential. In one dimension, say x9, I'll take the tachyon to asymptote to this value. And then, so that's for negative, x9 goes to negative infinity. And then as I go to x9 goes to plus infinity, I'll have the tachyon end up here. And then it'll go over the hump of the Mexican hat in between. Okay, so I can build this kink, but it's clearly an unstable kink since the tachyon can fall down over the hat in two directions. So that means what I've constructed here is a non-BPS DP minus one brain, one less dimension because I constructed this kink. So on this object, there's still a tachyon, meaning that I get this type of potential where now I'm sitting right here. And so motion along these direction corresponds to taking this kink and moving down the Mexican hat one direction or the other. Okay, but now I'm left with this potential and a real tachyon, which is the non-BPS DP minus one. I can go one step further and construct a kink from this theory. So I again take the same boundary conditions as I did now in, say, an x8 direction. And a kink on this part of potential, as shown here, is clearly a stable configuration since I have a real tachyon and I have a non-trivial pi zero of the vacuum manifold. And so this is identified with the stable BPS DP minus two brain. And the way you should be able to see that this thing is a BPS D brain is it should carry a Ramon-Ramon charge. And that should come from a coupling of the form integrated over the P minus 1 brain of DT wedged into the appropriate Ramon-Ramon gauge field. And so if you have a kink configuration, you integrate this DT, you precisely pick up charge under this gauge field.
This is just another way of creating a vortex.
Right, so this is a two-step description of creating a vortex. So I could have started here with this Mexican hat potential and then created a vortex, and I would have ended up with this thing. So you can describe a vortex as a kink of a kink. So to make this all precise, of course, what you'd like really is to understand the tachyon potential in detail and how the tachyon couples to all fields and so forth. Now, that's not a question you can answer systematically, because the tachyon has some string scale mass, and so we know how to compute actions from massless fields, but to include something which has a mass of order the string scale is not something we know how to do in any systematic way. So we should only rely on conclusions based on generic qualitative features of the tachyon potential.
Thing you constructed could be again a BPS state, right? When you have this one, so of course it could be a different BPS state compared with the previous one, but still in a sense it would be a stable and probably BPS state again.
It's conceivable in principle that it's a different state from a D brain. On the other hand, we have no other candidate for what that is besides a D brain, so we expect it's a D brain, a BPS D brain. But there's no direct computation that shows that. Okay, so what can we say in general grounds about the tachyon coupling of the tachyon potential? Well, one observation is that these...
There's one argument you can make, right? That if you look at an open string and then something with a tachyon bearing, then it's going to be stuck as it moves in the direction. And so instead of being directly a T direction, you do it like
okay, fair enough. Okay, so these brains are completely non-supersymmetric objects in some theory with an underlying 32 supersymmetries. And so if I have such a situation, there should be 32 Goldsteinov fermions present in the action for this non-supersymmetric object. Okay, so that's how you can see why in the previous open string spectrum there are always twice as many fermions as we got when we studied BPSD brains. For BPSD brains, we find 16 fermions because the brain breaks half the supersymmetries. Now we found twice as many fermions because the object was breaking all the supersymmetries.
But still, why you see that in this all supersymmetries are broken? It could be that still some are there.
Well, no, for the non-BPSD brain, you can...
No, it's definition, of course, but for the particular construction you have, it could not be,
Right. I'm making this.
And you think you will never go back to this generative potential? There's no way.
Yeah, and certainly weak coupling can just answer this question very directly. So, in the weak coupling limit, it's clearly these things. Yeah, you see that they break. Right. Okay. So the action, including the tachyon and all the fields, should have 32 non-linearly realized supersymmetries. So this led Sen to propose a particular form that had this feature manifest. What he did is he took this action, where this is the part of the supersymmetric Born-Infeld action. Now it's the un-kappa gauge fixed version of the supersymmetric Born-Infeld action. So in the normal Born-Infeld action, you'd have this part plus some Wess-Zimino term. Together, those would have a kappa symmetry, allowing you to gauge away half of the fermions, leaving you with 16 instead of 32. But here we don't add in the Wess-Zimino term, so we just keep this, so we have 32 fermions. Then we can multiply this by some unknown function of the tachyon, and this satisfies these properties. In addition, you might like that this function for constant tachyon will just be proportional to the tachyon potential. Then when the tachyon condenses down to the true vacuum, actually, this whole action will just vanish because the tachyon potential vanishes. And so Sen has argued that that's good because it explains why certain residual U1s, which you might think survive after tachyon condensation, are actually not present in the spectrum because of this property. Okay, so there's actually some sort of remarkable features about this action, if true, which is that, so I argued previously that for certain tachyonic kink configurations, I should actually restore some of the supersymmetry. For example, I'm able to build a tachyonic kink, which is a BPSD brain, and that should have half of the supersymmetries restored. So there should be some way of seeing in this, actually, that if you take T to be certain values, some of these non-linearly realized supersymmetries turn into linearly realized supersymmetries. But actually, that's not at all clear from this form of the action. So it's not clear to me, at least, that this action is correct in detail, since I don't see any mechanism for sort of unbreaking the supersymmetry. I think that's an interesting open question.
Can you write down a term somewhere with D of D, that's what your own remote
Right, so here I've turned off all the background remote enrollment fields, so I'm just looking at the action for the world volume fields, the open string fields.
Oh, I thought you were arguing that in configurations where the tachyon was varying, that object coupled to the remote enrollment field. I thought
that is the case. But I can set those background remote enrollment fields to zero if I choose. That's what I'm doing. I'm just writing an action for the fields in the presence of zero remote enrollment field. Yeah, I'm just going to set G string equal to zero basically, and just decouple all the other guys. No, actually, I'll actually come back to that. It's very difficult. Estimate, you can say it's of order one, but in terms of any calculation, you really can't. Okay, so that was sort of the little mini review. Now, where things get interesting is where you take the case of starting from D9 anti-D9 or non-BPS D9. So in this case, I have space-time filling non-BPS D-brains. And you can set up a sort of a general goal here, which is that I've shown how to, on these lower brains, how to describe BPS D-brains as kinks and so forth on the non-BPS D-brains. So you can try to ask if you can describe all the degrees of freedom of type 2 string theory in terms of open strings on these non-BPS objects. So in particular, you might want to be able to describe BPS D-brains, the lower non-BPS D-brains, fundamental strings, NS-brains, whatever. And if you could do that, then you would have some formulation of type 2 string theory in terms of open strings on these objects. So that's one sort of goal in the back of one's mind. So first, how to see the BPS D-brains as solitons on these objects. So this follows the sort of little toy pictures that I was drawing before. So the point is to look at the homotopy of the relevant vacuum manifolds following from the tachyon vacuum configurations I wrote down before. So in 2A, I said that the vacuum manifold was U2N divided by UN cross UN, and that has non-trivial homotopy groups for any even spheres equal to the integers. And then from the codimension here, this will correspond to some D8 minus 2K brain. If you set up boundary conditions such that this object is non-trivial, it will describe a D8 minus 2K brain. It's a stable object. Whereas the odd spheres here have vanishing homotopy. And so you see why there's only in 2A, only even dimensional stable BPSD brains, not odd dimensional ones. In 2B, it works out just the reverse. Now, the odd dimensional spheres have non-trivial homotopy. Again, the integers. So you get D minus 9 minus 2K brains, where even spheres have trivial homotopy. And so you don't get any stable configurations. And I should also say that to get non-trivial homotopy here, you actually have to take n. For a given k, you have to take n sufficiently large, given by this criterion, in order to get some non-trivial winding number. Okay, so that's what I wrote down before, taking some form for the vacuum form of the tachyon. And so, for example, in the 2A case, I started with the U2N gauge theory, and the tachyon broke that down to UN cross UN. So those are the space of vacua. So I can set up boundary conditions anywhere in the space, varying in the space of those vacua in some topologically non-trivial way.
And then,
okay, so in because I'm taking either I'm taking D9 anti-D9 for 2B, and the non-BPS D9 for 2A, and those are different world volume gauge theories.
If I start from the BPS D-brain, is it obvious what corresponds to the tachyon that you've appealed to
this dimension? How do you see the tachyon? Sort of the it's not obvious to me at all.
Maybe which direction? Is there any way to think
about
which direction of field space that you correspond to?
Right.
You mean how does the non-BPS thing? These things are always described by how you start with non-BPS and it decays and you get BPS, but What's the picture from there?
Right, can you see the
So the BPS end, what's the direction that you came in?
Isn't it just going to be a stringy excitation?
Well, there is a number of stringy excitations. Why is there one special one that's come up in the description?
I think there's one place you can look at the back and the there's some radii where you can see the debug.
Good.
Some radii where you can see the debug.
There's some cases where there is a control thing.
At one point, there's a marginal parameter.
So near that, I guess, is a nearly marginal thing to get out.
Okay, so simple examples of this are if you want to describe a BPS D6 brain as a soliton on two non-BPS D9 brains. What I do is I write down this asymptotic tachyon configuration. So sigma I here are the Pauli matrices, and so I write down sigma I, xi, where xi are in the 1, 2, 3 directions, and this gives me some non-trivial element of pi 2, and so it describes some stable object stretched along the x0, x4, to x9 directions. And so we identify that with the D6 brain. And then you can see how to generalize this. Instead of taking these 2x2 Pauli matrices, you can take the whatever dimension SOM gamma matrices for the tachyon and write down this gamma I, xi, where I runs from 1 to m. So here now I'm writing this squiggle. There's some overall, for all these constructions, there's some overall factor, f of r, in the directions, which makes the tachyon go to some vacuum value and makes everything convergent. But I'll generally be neglecting to write those down. So this is just the overall sort of topological form. Okay, so this is in m directions, and so I generate some d9 minus m brain corresponding to this element of pi m minus 1. Okay. Okay, so that's how to understand the BPS brains. Now to understand the unstable non-BPS brains, which we'll call these sphalerons. The point is, so I've described there that all these non-contractible loops correspond to these homotopy groups. And under some mild assumptions, when you have non-contractible spheres in the theory, that implies the existence of unstable solutions, which will be the non-BPSD brains. So the relation is very simple. So just consider a particle on a torus and a gravitational field is drawn here. So just some particle moving around on this torus. There's clearly some non-trivial loop if you take it around the torus going one direction. So if I move, what that means is I can move this loop around. At some point, I'll have to reach a point where the energy is stationary and, in fact, has just one negative direction, one negative mode. So I could also stationarize the action here, but then I'd have two negative modes. But there's guaranteed to be, just from the topology, a point where there's a solution with a single negative mode, and that's called the sphaleron. So we think of the vacuum here as being at the absolute minimum of the energy, and the sphaleron as being the point where there's a solution but with a single negative mode. So discussed by Manton in electroweak theory, these are relevant to baryon number violation as you go around the loop. Okay, so this also then generalizes to higher spheres. Instead of taking a loop, I can take higher non-contractible spheres, for example, a sphere in a gravitational field. And then by the same logic, clearly you're going to find some unstable solution now with two negative modes corresponding to rolling down the two directions of the sphere. So this is all true under certain global assumptions about the space of energy. So for example, if you had an object like this where these are asymptoting, where these are coming together asymptotically, clearly have these non-contractible loops here, but there's not going to be any point where you have a solution with a single negative mode. So you have to be a bit careful in applying these arguments to rule out cases like this.
If I could go back for a second, when you were talking about how to recover this sort of stable BPSD brain, so this theory, you started off asking if you could get everything, or even the fundamental string, out of this. Did you answer that? Or?
No, that's an open question. I mean, that's right. And then the NS brains, those are open questions.
Oh.
So I don't want to have anything to say about this. Okay, so example, how to see the non-BPS D0 2B as a sphaleron.
But I mean, the sphaleron is
perspective. Normally, I mean, further on notion gives you an idea of, you know, potential barrier, right? For none. Okay,
yeah.
For something. Mm-hmm. So in this way, this polygon would be describing potential for what?
It's not a potential between physically distinct vacua. I mean, it's not like an electro weak theory where you go over this hump and you create something. It's not like that. It's a barrier, but the place you come back to is indistinguishable from where you started.
Okay. You know that true? I remember asking around about this question.
Well, we have no evidence that it's not true. Look at this way. We have no evidence that you go over this barrier and you go. You, pardon?
No, as you see in the theory, it's also actually, it's not a prism, it's something which could be viewed as equivalent of original point, but in terms of physics, you are saying that it is an invariant number production or whatever, but you still can say that it is
The initial states and the final states differ by some large gauge transformation, and this is the minimum barrier path between going from this gauge transformation and one differing by large gauge transformation. There's no corresponding story here.
No.
I can go between these points by not going over this barrier.
And also, you could say that it is kind of motion in one direction, which is kind of random number coordinates, right? Something which you can formulate what kind of coordinates we are moving along. And here, I mean, in this way, it's interesting. Yeah, what kind of coordinates are associated with you?
There's not the same kind of physical effects associated with these things as in the electro weak theory. There's nothing, no analog of baryon number violation. Okay, let's see if we can speed up. Okay, so example, the non-BPS D0 of 2B. So the space we want to consider is the space of finite energy, nine-dimensional field configurations. And we want to look for a non-contractible loop in this space. So let me take 32 D9 anti-D9 pairs with a U32 gauge theory and a tachyon in the bifundamental. Then let me define the 32 by 32 SO10 gamma matrices. And then I can write down a non-contractible loop in this space just by taking an asymptotic form of the tachyon like this. So I have this nine-dimensional part, and I have this extra parameter, S. This is the parameter along the non-contractible loop, which I'll take to run from minus infinity to infinity. So as this parameter goes from net minus infinity to infinity, again, there's a convergence factor here such that this is finite as I take any coordinate out to infinity. Doing that, the tachyon will just then go to plus or minus gamma 10 for large S. And that differs by gauge transformation. This really is a loop. You come back yourself up to a gauge transformation. So given this construction, given that we can make this non-contractible loop in the space of finite energy nine-dimensional configurations, then we expect that there is a soliton with a single negative mode. And so that we identify with D0 brain that you see at weak string coupling from the explicit quantization. Okay, so similarly, for 2A, you can construct a non-BPS D instanton, D minus 1 brain, by finding a loop in the space of finite action, 10-dimensional Euclidean field configurations. So in that case, we take 32 non-BPS D9 brains with their content, and then I write down a very similar asymptotic form for the tachyon, where mu runs now from 1 to 10, and I have this extra loop parameter. Okay, so by the very same argument, I go around this loop. So I expect there's some unstable instanton-like object, which we identify with the non-BPS D minus 1 brain. Now, it's kind of tempting here to identify this with some physical 11th dimension, just given the form. In that case, you would try to make this seem like some M-theory instanton or something, some 11-dimensional instanton, which from the 10-dimensional point of view would then be a D minus 2 brain, if you think about it. It's a tempting thing. We don't know how to make that any more precise than what I've just said. Also, I should mention that when we started thinking about this, it was because of this this non-BPS D instanton, which has a single negative mode. As Petter talked about in his talk, if you have instantons with single negative modes, those are usually associated with vacuum decay in a theory. So we were wondering if type 2A might be unstable due to some vacuum decay. But that turns out not to be the case. This instanton does not satisfy other properties that you need an instant to satisfy in order to have immediate vacuum decay. It can't be continued into Lorentzian signature. It's the basic problem. Right, you can't cut it and continue it. Okay, so there are, at this point, two natural questions, I think. So on a previous transparency, I described there are all these higher non-contractible spheres, higher than these loops that I've written down. So what is the interpretation of these higher non-contractible spheres? Second of all, from the string theory construction, we know we can construct multiple coincident non-BPSD brains. In particular, if you take M coincident non-BPSD brains, you get some objects with M squared negative modes, not just a single negative mode anymore. So how can we understand these objects? So it turns out that the 1 and 2 are basically questions with the same answer. The higher non-contractible spheres describe the multi-Sphaleron objects. So let me give an example. Let me look at two D0 brains, two non-BPSD D0 brains of 2B. So instead of taking 32 D9 anti-D9 pairs, I'll now take 64 of these, as I'm free to do. Then let me define the gamma twiddles to be the SO12 gamma matrices. And now I'll write down the following form for the tachyon, which gives me some non-trivial element now of pi 3 instead of pi 1. So I've introduced three extra coordinates. This is some non-trivial pi 3. So I think of the vacuum, it's convenient to think of the vacuum as being at some point, the point at infinity for these extra parameters. And then at the other pole of the sphere is when these parameters go to 0. So I want to identify the Sphaleron with a point where these three parameters vanish. Okay, so this should give me some non-contractible S3 in the space of finite energy nine-dimensional configurations. So to see why this represents two non-BPS D0 brains, you can just look at the place where these things vanish, which is the opposite pole of the S3. So let me decompose these SO12 gamma matrices into the SO10 gamma matrices using the standard form. And so then the tachyon at this opposite pole of the sphere takes this form. Now, this is, in fact, two non-BPS D0 brains, if you remember the previous construction of the D0 brain. So for the single D0 brain, I took this construction with the SO10 gamma matrices, and the Sphaleron would have been at S equals 0. And so now I have this block structure where I get two of them. So I built this from this non-contractible S3. I've now described two coincident non-BPS D0 brains. So we'd like to understand how to count up the negative modes. They carry no charge, no conserved charge. All right, so type 1, if you project out the tachyon, then you get something with a conserved Z2 charge, but not in type 2. Yeah, I mean, they're unstable, of course, but you can put them on top of each other. Yeah, there are any number is unstable. Okay, so how do we count up the negative modes on these two coincident non-BPS D0 brains? We want to find four negative modes. Okay, so we're sitting at the far pole of this non-contractible S3. So right away you get three negative modes. If you just, this S3 is this local maximum of the energy. So if you do any motions on the S3, then that'll decrease the energy and so give you a negative mode. And so that's what I've written down here for some, I've just turned on these extra three parameters, S1, S2, and S3. To get this tachyon configuration. And so this describes three negative modes. So I still want one more negative mode. Well, that comes because I still have a non-contractible S1 from before. So with each non-BPS D0 brain, it's in addition sitting at some pole of some non-contractible S1. And so I can turn on that parameter like this. And this will give me an extra negative mode. This is not equivalent to this. And if you might ask why I put this in this slot instead of down here. Well, those are just equivalent by gauge transformation, so there's really only one extra negative mode. So indeed, by this construction, you find four negative modes, which is the correct number. And then you can go and generalize this to the arbitrary case. And so the general formula is that if you write m squared as the sum of odd integers up to 2m minus 1, then you can easily interpret how this counting goes. So if in general, if I take M D0 brains, if I want M D0 brains, I'll take U32M. Now, from the homotopy, this has non-contractible odd spheres all the way from S1 up to a maximal 2m minus s to 2m minus 1. You cannot go higher than this. Those are not stable. So we want to say that the configuration at the far end of these spheres represents MD0 brains. And so if I take motion on any one of these spheres, then on a K-sphere, it gives me 2K minus 1 negative modes. And so I just count all those up in this fashion, K running up from 1 to M. And I find a total of M squared negative modes, which is what I want. So we understand the general counting of the negative modes on coincident non-BPSD brains. And you can do this for other brains and brains of various types and so forth, and it generalizes. Well, you saw them in the open string construction of weak coupling. So I just quantized the strings, and I saw that there were tachyons. So these are those things. Yeah, you can do that case as well, actually. You can work that out similarly. Just by taking sort of block diagonal structures, you can get that case. Okay, so now I'll turn to something different, which is an attempt to understand unstable non-BPSD brains in supergravity. These brains are unstable that I'm talking about, so I have to admit right off that I'm not even sure if this is a sensible thing to be talking about, to be talking about supergravity solutions for unstable string theory objects. But let me hope it is and see where that leads me. So maybe we'll find, for example, some unstable supergravity solution. Okay, so we don't have supersymmetry anymore, so we have fewer guiding criteria than we did when we looked for solutions for BPSD brains. All we really have is a symmetry in the field content. So we know on this extremal non-BPS brain, there's some SOP, 1 symmetry along the brain, and then some rotational SO9 minus P symmetry. Also, non-BPSD brains couple only to the metric and to the dilaton. There's no Ramond fields present. For example, you can see that from the boundary state construction of these objects. Okay, so since these are the only fields excited, it's convenient to think of the 2A case and then lift this whole setup to M theory in 11 dimensions, and then only the metric in 11 dimensions will be excited. And those, when dimensionally reduced, will give the 10-dimensional metric and dilaton. So we want to know what the most general 11-dimensional solution in M theory with these symmetries is. And so that's a fairly straightforward exercise to work out, or you can look in Callan, Myers, and Perry from 88 or so. So here's the general solution. So these are the directions along the brain. This tau is the M theory direction. And then you have this sphere here and so forth, and various definitions. Here's the function f that appears in various places. Various ugly coefficients. So the points to denote, I guess, are that there are in the solution three free parameters. So there's R0, there's beta, so alpha is not a free parameter, it appears in terms of beta, and then there's the free periodicity of the M-theory circle. So in 10 dimensions, of course, this would be the string coupling. Some combination of R0 and beta is the mass, and then there's one more free parameter floating around. Okay, so these solutions are generically singular solutions. They are singular when you go down to R0. If you want a non-singular solution, there are only two subcases that are non-singular. One of them gives a non-extremal black three-brain solution. That's some finite temperature thing, so I want to look for some zero temperature solutions. I won't consider that. So the other non-singular object is the 10 minus p dimensional Euclidean Schwarzschild solution cross Rp, 1. In other words, this metric, the p, 1. This is Euclidean Schwarzschild written in coordinates which are maybe a little bit unfamiliar, but these are the isotropic coordinates. This is Euclidean Schwarzschild. Okay, so could this Euclidean Schwarzschild cross Rp, 1 be the supergravity solution for a non-BPSD brain? So it has a couple of good properties which might make you think so. So first of all, this solution has a single negative mode. So as, I guess, first shown by Gross, Perry, and Yaffe in their study of instability of flat space at finite temperature, this can be interpreted as mediating a vacuum decay, and so there is a single negative mode for the solution. So that's good because we're trying to understand solutions for unstable D-brains. Second of all, this thing really is a D-brain. The supergravity solution really is a D-brain. Because if you look at the topology of this thing in M-theory, well, I have this 8 minus P sphere here, and then the RT plane is the Euclidean Schwarzschild cigar. It's this smooth cigar which runs off to a cylinder, but is smooth at the origin. So you can take an M2 brain in 11 dimensions and wrap it around this cigar at some point on the 8 minus P sphere. And in 10 dimensions, of course, an M2 brain looks like a fundamental string. So this wrapping from the 10-dimensional point of view looks like a fundamental string which comes and smoothly ends on this object. So it's a D-brain. Okay, so that's the good properties. The bad properties, the one killer property, is that this is not the solution we're looking for, because this solution has a unique spin structure. The fermions on the solution have to be anti-periodic around the tau direction. So that clearly breaks supersymmetry. And so this solution cannot exist in the standard type 2 supersymmetric vacuum. So what can one say then? So one has to consider then, these are the only non-singular solutions. They don't quite have the right properties. So we have to consider the singular solutions. And at that point, I guess you could hope that these nice properties might somehow be carried over, might act like a D-brain, have a negative mode, and so forth. But that's not really something we can address in the supergravity approximation. Right, so this would be the instanton mediating decay of M-theory. This would contribute to M-theory at finite temperature, that's right. Wait, M-theory at finite temperature. So you want to
What is the D-brain?
Yeah. That's right. I wanted the fermions to be antiperiodic, so that's right. So this thing would contribute to M-theory finite temperature.
But then the theory would be terribly unstable. I mean, if you allow things like this, you can find solutions with arbitrarily negative energy. So your instability would be minor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. These boundary conditions for the space fluctuation.
The object, I mean, so there exists this thing, the M-theory, where I just came out of this, which is,
can't be in the D-brain.
Not as a D-brain in the supersymmetric vacuum, because of the bad spin structure.
So you said the object is a D-brain, then
what? Well, I mean strings can end in this thing. So if you looked at some, for example, it's Bergman and Gabardiel conjectured that type 0 string theory is M-theory with antiperiodic fermions. So you might want to introduce this object into that theory, and then it would act like a D-brain in that theory. I was doing this at zero temperature. I mean, so I want this to be the... Okay, so that's all I have to say about the supergravity solutions. The final topic is some comments about D8 brains and massive 2A. Again, there'll be some puzzles here. So 2A has this 10-form field strength, as shown Chinsky. And we can find supersymmetric vacua in type 2A where the 10-form field strength is constant and non-vanishing, and that acts like a cosmological constant proportional to F10 squared. Further, we have this theory BPS, D8 brains, which act as domain walls for F10. So the F10 jumps across crossing a D8 brain by an amount equal to the tension of the D8 brain. And it's been argued in these papers that F10 is in fact quantized, and quantized in units commensurate with the jump here upon crossing a D8 brain. So So I'm allowed to have f10 equals 0 or f10 equals mu h or any integral multiple of those quantities. Okay, so it's natural to ask then from this general philosophy, what are these features I can recover starting from these non-BPS D9 brains and looking at objects on those D9 brains. Okay, so first we want to understand D8 brain. Okay, so that follows from the discussion I've been giving on a single D9. So I'll start with a single D9 brain. We have this real tachyon, and then I can make a kink on this D9 brain, and that should represent a D8 brain. So I give boundary conditions of the tachyon like this. I'm putting the kink in the x9 direction, so it has these boundary conditions. And I want this kink to carry R charge for the Ramondre 9 form. This is the object whose derivative gives the 10 form. So I expect that there's some sort of coupling on the D9 brain of this form, of mu8 divided by 2t0 and this vt wedge c9. So that when I have this kink going from minus t0 to 2t0, I jump, t jumps by 2t0, and so I integrate that, and I just pull out a mu8 multiplying the c9, and that gives me, that'll give me the jump in f10, saying a kink. Okay, so that's for a single 8 brain. You can take multiple, do this for multiple D9 brains and multiple D8 brains. So then, again, I expect a coupling where now I have the trace of dt coupling to c9 in the same form. And if I want to write down multiple d8 brains, I just make these block structure with kinks down the diagonal. Okay, now, so what are the vacuum configurations here for these d9 brains? So previously, I was taking t to be a traceless. But now let me consider the more general case, in which t is, again, proportional to t0. Then I'll have some number of k plus 1 eigenvalues and then n minus k minus 1 eigenvalues. Okay, so let me ask what happens if I start from the D9 brains, which are at t equals 0, and then let t condense into this vacuum. From the coupling at the top of the page and Maxwell's equations, then you find that in this process of condensation, F10 will jump by an amount mu8 divided by 2t0 times the change in the trace of t. So you see right away that if I start with an odd number of D9 brains, then after the thing is condensed, F10 will have changed by some half-odd integral, or by some n plus 1 half, or n is an integer, multiples of mu8. So this you can ask, is this inconsistent with the previous? So before I argued that there are arguments that F10 is quantized in integral units of mu, now in this process you find it changes by n plus 1 half times mu 8. So is this inconsistent? Okay, so as a first effort to check if there could be some flaw in this reasoning, we'd clearly like to know, is this coupling actually correct? So it's very difficult to actually compute numerically what this value is, basically because you have this t0 in the denominator, which is the position of the tachyon at the bottom of the potential. But knowing what the position, knowing what t0 is, requires knowing details of the tachyon potential, and that's something we simply don't know, and it requires, we don't know how to compute that. So there's no systematic way of computing this coefficient. So how can we be sure, for example, that we weren't off by a factor of 2, and that this kink describes 2 D8 brains, in which case this change here would be multiplied by 2, and I'd be back to the standard units of F10. Okay, so to check this, what we did is we asked, well, if we're describing a single D8 brain by a kink, then on a single D8 brain, there's a single Majorana of fermion living on the world volume of that object. So if it was 2 D8 brains, you'd find 4 Majorana fermions. So by working out the fermion zero modes on this kink, we can check if this describes a single D8 brain. Okay, so we start from some action on the 9 brain for the fermions, and then we'll look for these fermion zero modes. Okay, so we don't know, of course, the detailed form of the action, but we've written down sort of a general form. So on the D9 brain, we have these two Majorana Weil fermions, psi plus and psi minus, of opposite chirality. And so here are their kinetic terms, and we multiply by some function of the tachyon, which I'll say something about in a second. And then we also allow for this Yukawa coupling multiplied by some other function of the tachyon. Okay, so we don't know the detailed form of these F1 and F2, but there are some general properties known. First of all, this F1 should have the same sort of basic features it should die off at infinity. It should go to zero. And this is connected with that form of the action that Sen wrote down. If you want to solve this residual U1 problem, you want the action to go to zero at large distances, and then you'll be really in the true vacuum. So we take F1 to have this form. Now for F2, first of all, there's this Z2 symmetry I mentioned earlier, which flips the sign of the tachyon and of psi minus. So from this form and the Z2 symmetry, we need there to be an odd number of powers of the tachyon. And then by the same logic, you want it to go to zero off at large distances. And so we write down this form here for the tachyon. So in particular, you could take F2 to be this. So this is, I might have been a little confusing. So this is the form of F1 and F2 when you put in for the tachyon the kink background for the tachyon. Then you find this value for F1 and F2 in position space. Okay, so given that action then, we can go and look for fermion zero modes. Well, I should say the final assumption was that F1 and F2 are each vanishing infinity, but I make the further assumption that the ratio is non-vanishing for large X9. Okay, so to look for the zero modes, we just define these new linear combinations of psi plus and psi minus. Then the Dirac equation in the background of the kink takes this form. F1 prime is the derivative of F1 with respect to X9, the gamma 9 appearing. And so you solve this to find this formula. Now we want these zero modes to be normalizable. So from this form, you can see, for example, that for the chi plus to be normalizable, I clearly want to project onto the gamma 9 equals minus I eigenvalue of chi plus. So I'm in a Majorana representation, so the gamma matrices are purely imaginary here. So they have purely imaginary eigenvalues, and I can project onto the minus I eigenvalue of chi plus to get a normalizable zero mode. And similarly for chi minus, I project onto the plus I eigenvalue. So given that I do that projection to find the normalizable zero modes, at the end of the day, I do in fact find a single Majorana fermion zero mode on this kink, because I started with two Majorana Weil fermions in 10 dimensions. Making these projections gives me a single Majorana fermion in 8 plus 1 dimensions on the wall. As a side note, it's interesting that if you look in Alvarez, Gomez, and Witten, an odd number of Majorana fermions in 8 plus 1 dimensions actually has a potential global gravitational anomaly. So if that's realized here, this would give presumably some form of anomaly inflow for a global gravitational anomaly, since the starting 9 plus 1 dimensional theory is not anomalous, whereas the 8 plus 1 dimensional one might be. Okay, so there really was just a single 8 brain there at the kink. So what's the resolution of this puzzle of the quantization? So I think what the resolution is that if you start from an odd number of D9 brains, you can't actually have an odd number of D9 brains with vanishing F10. In the presence of odd number of D9 brains, you really have to have F10 equal to some n plus 1/2 units of mu8. Then when the tachyon rolls down from zero down to the true vacuum, they'll again change by some n plus 1/2 u8, leaving you with the integral quantization that you expect. Okay, so I think odd numbers of D9 brains cannot exist without F10 backgrounds. The other possibility, I guess, is that an odd number of D9 brains is simply inconsistent for some reason, but haven't seen any signs of that inconsistency, or possibly there's something else that we haven't thought of. But I think I'll stop there.
Of non-BPS 9 will nucleate above the Roman theory. some sort of positive effect on one component. Is that the big question?
Yeah.
VA frames will be inserting, presumably non-VPN VA frames will be inserting.
Well, that's not the picture. I was giving the picture of the tack just sort of rolling down homogeneously throughout space. You could roll down and produce the eight grains as well.
Right.
That's certainly possible.
Well, I mean, if that's been turned on, I'm just trying to get what is the final state of this.
The final state is one of the Romans vacua with the F10 equals the standard integral values. Nakedly singular. Oh yeah, right. Exactly. I haven't turned on any of the closed string fields here, but right, you get one of those vacua with the dilatine. Well, I'm not turning on sort of the background gravitation or anything like that. So this is all going on at the open string level. So you don't see those singularities.
If you take this as a single V-brain, then we know that sort of the dilatine that it creates at large distance. So it goes to a constant plus a term which is proportional to the charge. So the non-trivial one or the positive charge. So am I correct in thinking that if you take this sort of D, you know, D brain, anti-D brain pair, and look at the dilaton far away, it's going to go to a constant, and then you won't have the sort of expected term, but you'll have a higher order correction because the charge is zero.
That's right. So I could start with, say, a D brain, anti-D brain, at finite separation, that the leading term would be vanishing, that leading term of the charge, but I'd have some multipole moments, which would be non-vanishing.
But I was just thinking, if you look at your metrics that you were trying to associate with it, I'm not sure you could adjust the parameters to cancel that leading term in the dilaton without maybe setting the dilaton to a constant.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, I'm confused. I mean, these have a non-trivial dilaton charge. These objects. Yeah, I mean, they're the same. Their boundary state in the NS sector is the same as for the BPS brains. So, up to a sort of a factor of square root of two, actually, they couple the same way to the dilaton as a BPS brain would.
Something wrong with the next thing first. Your single D brain goes like the remote remote charge, the leading order, you know, deviation from constant. If you can total the remote remote charge, then it's like coefficient. It's an independent parameter.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Do you have the value of the charge?
In the metric, it's a lot. Now, anybody wants to decide the dilaton? Yeah, so I'm saying it's the same as for a BPS deep brain.
But then you can pick it.
There's an extra parameter, right.
You can fix that by considering
the by three parameters, so I can fix.
You can replace the three with two.
That's right. I can fix the mass and the dilaton, I can fix. I still have a free parameter.
No, but
then
that's just in another part of the metric.
What are the three conditions?
If I dimensionally reduce that, there's in some sense another scale of the field that you're associating with the compact
direction. The dilaton.
That's part of the metric. You should be able to see it.
I mean, that's just the dilaton, right? I mean,
right. So you can compactify X11 or whatever.
Right.
If you've got a scale of the field, you call the dilaton, but you could compactify the world volume direction, and you have another scale in the theory that you associate with that compactor field.
Okay.
And there'd be a charge associated with that.
Uh-huh.
So that's one way of interpreting this as a map and some scale of you should be able to see all three of them, but it's relatively.
Okay, well, I'd like to have a demo about that.
Okay, if not the question, if it's the last meeting of the program, and we also have to go to the on behalf of participants, I believe that we can recognize this, right? And our speaker as well.
Left to the bargaining organizer.